You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, despite more awareness of the overdose treatment naloxone, most police departments in the country don't carry it. We'll talk to an expert on drug and addiction policy about why and how it's worked for the police departments who do have it on hand. Now, the experience of drinking for many Wisconsinites starts in their teenage years. In 2017, 65% of high schoolers in the state reported having had at least one alcoholic beverage. That's 5 percentage points above the national average. As part of WPR's High Tolerance series, we're taking a look at what fuels teen drinking in Wisconsin and efforts to prevent it. You can read and listen to our whole series at WPR.org/alcohol. Julia Sherman is the coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW Law School. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, can you give us a sense overall of trends in teen drinking in the last couple of decades?
Teen drinking has actually been going down in the last 10 years. Underage drinking increased in the latter part of the 1990s, and at the same time, the national age of first drink was dropping precipitously. By the time we got to the first years of the 21st century, the average age of first drink, alcohol initiation, which is very important, had actually dropped below age 13. Since then, that has been increasing. That age is going up. But in addition, overall, underage alcohol use, teenage drinking, has been dropping. And that's good news, but we're still above the national average here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I had touched on that briefly. Talk more about how we in Wisconsin compare with the rest of the nation when it comes to rates of teen drinking, and I guess that age of first drink, too.
Wisconsin has a couple of individual features when it comes to our alcohol use. First, we have more people drinking, period, of every age. So we really shouldn't be too surprised that we have a higher rate of underage drinking. Kids live in our alcohol culture and our alcohol environment. They respond to us. They respond to what they see going on about them. So we are, in fact, have a higher rate of underage drinking. We've been dropping following the national trend, but at the same time, we remain a few points above it.
And as I understand it, we've been dropping more slowly as compared to the decrease we've seen in teen drinking at the national level. Is that right?
That's correct. And in the last couple of years, it's really slowed quite a bit. As a result, there's a chance it might actually go up a tick.
Now, let's talk about that age of first drink. You touched on that. Why is that such an important thing to be watching for?
We've known for a long time that age of first drink has a great deal to do with a child's later risk of alcohol abuse or dependence. A child that begins drinking at age 14 or earlier actually increases their lifetime risk of alcohol dependence or abuse from 10% that we're all born with because we're human to over 40%. That's a pretty dramatic increase. Recent research has shown that 6th, 7th, and 8th grades are critical because youth that begin drinking in those years also have a greater lifetime chance of illicit drug use. And when that happens, we're talking about opiates, we're talking about prescription drugs, we're talking about heroin. So those early years, the age of early alcohol initiation, it really sets children up for later problems if they begin drinking. Pushing back that age of first use has got to be a priority for all of us these days, simply to protect the health of our children.
Talking to Julia Sherman, coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the UW Law School, looking at teens and drinking in Wisconsin. All right, Julia, if that's our top priority, getting the kids to wait, put off that first drink for a year or another 5 or 10 years for that matter, what do we know that works?
Well, children are not that different than adults. Step one, we make it less available to them. The easiest place for a kid in Wisconsin to get a beer, or most of them are drinking beer, is in the refrigerator right next to the milk. People don't think that they should about securing alcohol, and they really need to, especially if they're keeping a lot of it on hand. There is often an ugly refrigerator in the garage that's full of beer. Kids have been known to go from unlocked garage to unlocked garage, collecting one or two beers at a time, and nobody misses one or two beers in Wisconsin. It has a name, garage shopping. Some community coalitions are working with police forces to give people that live near schools these easy stick-on refrigerator locks. If you're having a party or you're home, you don't have to lock it. But it's wise to do it when you're away, simply because middle school kids are pretty easily deterred. If they can't open it, they'll move on.
What do we know? I know we survey teens about drinking, whether they do it, and also I understand how they get access to the alcohol. What do we know about where they go to get those first drinks?
Good question. We know that most of the alcohol that young teens drink is actually legally purchased. They get it from family members or friends who are over age 21. You know, many folks don't think to tell family members that have just become 21 that they shouldn't be providing alcohol to their younger cousins, siblings, stepsibs, and we need to tell them that. But there are some merchants that will sell to underage. So it really comes down to a couple of things. We need to reduce the commercial availability of alcohol to kids, and we do that with alcohol age compliance checks. Those are done at the local level by police, and it's amazing. If you do regular alcohol age compliance checks a couple times a year in your community, you will find that within the second year that you will have well over 90%. Then, at the same time, you look at non-commercial availability, and that's the alcohol that's pilfered, and it's the locations, the people that are providing a location for underage drinking. We've got a new social host law in this state that makes it illegal to provide a location for underage drinking. That's a very useful tool because it says that if you occupy and occupy or control premises, there's underage drinking going on there, or you fail to take steps to prevent it, you can get a citation for $500, and that's going to make most people sit up and listen.
Now that exists in law. Do you think the word has gotten out there enough? I imagine the goal there isn't so much we want to give out lots of fines so much as we want to discourage this from happening in the first place.
This follows up on over 50 municipal ordinances that were ruled inoperable as a result of a court case. They found that often municipal judges would not allow people to pay the fine. They had to come in, plead their case in front of the municipal judge, who then denied their miserable excuse and fined them whatever the law allowed them to be fined. We found that word can get out on these laws if they're enforced. Just last week, in Fond du Lac County, the Fond du Lac Sheriff's Department responded quickly to a noise complaint and found a party with 10 young women, all underage, who were from Illinois, and citations were issued. They're examining the facts to see if a social host ordinance, social host law, is appropriate. But that's already been covered on local TV up there, and I think we'll see more stories about it.
I want to get into alcohol marketing. There's a lot of concern with alcohol either sort of nudge-nudge being marketed to kids or being marketed to grown-ups in such a way that kids aren't going to miss it. What do you see out there?
I see a lot of alcohol marketing. Some of it is unintentional, but it still impacts kids. For example, we know that the CDC says alcohol marketing and products should be kept 36 inches from the floor. So it's not in the eyesight of toddlers. Yet we see alcohol advertising stacked on the floor of grocery stores. A lot of convenience stores, they put sleeve advertising over bollards, those yellow posts in the parking lot. A lot of sign codes don't permit them. And the communities that do have sign codes, enforcing the sign code isn't their top priority. In addition, we know that kids see so much alcohol advertising on billboards, on television. It's remarkable. The number of movies that have alcohol placement as part of it, that's doubled in the past decade. And 15% of the movies that are kid-rated, G and PG, have some alcohol consumption or product placement in it. Kids see a lot of subtle cues about alcohol advertising. And in here in Madison, our buses are gift-wrapped. We see shrink-wrapped advertising for alcohol, and those buses are going up and down the streets all across the city all day, all night.
Talking to Julia Sherman, coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW Law School, about the issue of teen drinking here in the state. We'll go to your calls now. Paula is with us in La Crosse. Paula, hi.
Oh, hi.
What do you want to bring up, Paula?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. Growing up here in the Midwest and such a cultural thing. I think growing up, I just thought it was normal that when people came to your house, the first thing you asked them was, can I get you a beer? This was just a very cultural thing. And obviously, as I got a little older and, you know, the drinking culture, drinking age was 16 when I was much younger. I'm just about 57. But I just think there's still a very cultural thing regarding drinking. And I, quarter barrel of beer was always tapped in my parents' basement.
Paula, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to be talking a lot about the culture of drinking in our alcohol series. I know that's an issue you look at, too. But talk about how that culture of drinking does, Julia, trickle down to the kids watching that beer get served.
Absolutely. And Paula's comments show that it does make a difference. But the fact is, we are the culture, and culture changes. It doesn't mean that Paula's parents were bad or any other parent at that time was bad. We know so much more now about how alcohol affects the developing brain. And we also know about the dangers that underage drinking can cause. We used to think that really if children got home safely, there wasn't a drunk driving crash, the worst was over. When in fact now we know that early alcohol use carries a risk of dangers we never even considered. We know better, and now we need to do better. The culture can change. 100 years ago in Wisconsin, I couldn't have voted because I was a woman. Culture changes.
Thanks a lot for the call, Paula. Let's go to Randall now in Hartford. Randall, hi. Randall, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, what'd you want to bring up, Randall?
The only thing I got to bring up is it's mainly more of the parental controls than anything. If the kids are just there without any parental guidance, they're more likely to get it to alcohol.
Couldn't completely make out over the line, Randall, but it sounds like he was saying, Julia, parents have a lot of control over the situation when it comes to drinking. Can you talk about the role of parents a little more?
Well, parents are very important, but at the same token, parents aren't the only factor. You can be one and even the most important factor, but we know overall that the availability of alcohol, if it's everywhere, that will have an impact on people. If they see children, see adults drinking all the time at every occasion, that has an impact on kids. If it was just a matter of telling your children no, we wouldn't have this problem. We need to do more than that.
Do we know, when it comes to curriculum, either messages that parents can give or that health class in school, do we know what kind of messages work when it comes to preventing drinking or helping prevent it, apart from just say no?
We know that kids look at more than the message. We know that kids are looking to see how we behave, how we conduct ourselves. They are sponges for the environment overall. There's a lot of research that goes into the different messages. One of the issues we have right now is that girls respond to different messages than young boys do. And girls are actually in many parts of the nation drinking at a higher rate than young men are. We need to get more sophisticated about that to make our messages effective. And even if we had the most effective message in the world, freestanding, it's not enough. We have to change attitudes, and we have to reduce the availability of alcohol to youth.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about teens and drinking in Wisconsin. Julia Sherman's with us, coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project. Back to your calls now. Heather is with us in Rochester, Minnesota. Heather, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment, and then I had a question for your guest. I am a mother of three. I also was a youth director in a program that included well over 100 kids in junior and senior high. And I had noticed that the kids that I got to know well, despite exposure to other at-risk situations or behaviors, those that had had families who spoke about the negative effects of alcohol when they were very young, and it was a common conversation, not just a sit down and tell them off kind of conversation, not in a situation where they were in trouble, I should say, or being disciplined. Were those conversations about the negative effects of alcohol on their body and their decision making, and also some sometimes real mature conversations about the effects of alcohol that the parents had seen, those kids just had less interest that they were less interested in drinking, period. And even that kind of what I noticed is that translated into drug use too, that they were also less interested in that. And coming from a family where I personally had two close family members who were alcoholic well into their senior citizen years, I would say that we've had some of those conversations with our kids, and I feel like it's helped them have maybe a context to put around it so that they're already in elementary school not interested in how those negative effects might be a part of their life someday. They're really not interested in being a part of that. Now, they are young.
So Heather, I want to jump in. You said you had a question, too, for Julia?
I do. I have a question. I was just wondering, growing up in the Midwest, I noticed the same thing with alcohol being just a part of what people do for entertainment. And I wondered if your guest could talk a little bit more about if there's any research about why we're noticing more alcohol consumption with younger teens and younger in the Midwest versus other places, other parts of the country.
Heather, thanks. Julia, what do you think?
Well, first of all, we're asking the question now. People wouldn't have thought about third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders drinking until we started asking the question and finding out that, in fact, they were drinking. We wouldn't have thought about looking at this until research was done that showed that the alcohol industry was actually advertising on shows where the great majority of viewers were going to be preteens and young teens. So it's been a process, but we're getting there. And what you've shown is that early discussions make a difference. Educators and health educators are now recommending that alcohol education begin in third grade. When I had teens in the house, we talked about it 16. Now, in fact, I would have missed the boat by 5-6 years if I'd waited that long.
Thanks for that call and for sharing your story. Steve joins us now in Madison. Steve, hello.
Hi. I am 70, but I started drinking when I was 15, and largely because that was all I experienced in the family that I grew up in, especially among the males, was my dad drank a lot and all his friends drank a lot. My grandfather drank a lot. And they would, when they had parties at the house, they would all drink like mad. And then I remember even as a tiny kid coming down in the morning when they were still sleeping and, you know, sampling half filled glasses of alcohol, my brother and I. So we thought it was cool. At 15, we started drinking. We had a drinking club in high school, and we went out, you know, every weekend and didn't have any trouble getting a hold of it, and just drank. And then I quit drinking when I was 31, when my oldest child was 1 year old. And I've had raised four kids to adulthood, and neither my wife nor I drank.
Wow.
In their presence, or we don't drink at all, and we didn't have a problem with the kids. They drink now, but they drink very responsibly.
Steve, I'm going to jump in because we only have a couple minutes left. But thank you so much for sharing that story. And Julia, can you take us to lessons for parents who do drink? How can they do that in a way that maybe isn't going to send the messages that Steve got from his parents?
It's a story I've heard too often. And congratulations, Steve! Mm-hmm. You've done a great job raising your own kids. First of all, is to recognize kids are listening and watching. And so when you drink in their presence, and I'm not saying you can't, drink responsibly. In other words, drink moderately. Don't drink more than two or three beverages. The second thing is to make it very clear to them early on that alcohol is an adult substance and they are not to drink in the house, and that you are watching them and there will be consequences. It's amazing that alone makes it clear to kids. Now, that alone won't change their behavior, but at least you've set out a baseline there.
Thanks again for that call. In our last minute or so, Julia, do you see Wisconsin moving in the right direction on teen drinking?
Yes, and I think these calls show that people are thinking about this, and they're thinking about how their childhoods progressed, and in fact, they know that change can occur, and that change will be for the better. You know, there's a wonderful Maya Angelou line from poetry that said, "I did what I knew, and when I knew better, I did better." Culture isn't destiny. we can all be better parents, and we can all be better neighbors and community members. We need to look at underage drinking and especially childhood drinking because the effects are devastating, and we're seeing them now.
Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Julia Sherman is the coordinator of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at UW Law School. She was with us to talk about the problem of teen drinking in the state and what can help prevent it. You can read more about this issue in an online piece written by WPR's Mary Kate McCoy and Elizabeth Domes. Find that at WPR.org/alcohol. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, join guest host John Munson for the next installment in our ongoing series on alcohol in Wisconsin, with a look at shopping under the influence and the big money that's being made when people buy stuff while drinking. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, more than 130 people die every day in the U.S. from overdosing on opioids. That's according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, a part of the National Institutes of Health. As the opioid epidemic continues, there's growing public awareness of a drug called naloxone, which has the ability to, in many cases, reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. But according to data from the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, even with more awareness, the vast majority of police departments in the U.S. still don't carry that drug. Regina LaBelle is the program director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative at Georgetown University's Law School. She has served as chief of staff and senior policy advisor in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy during the Obama administration. Regina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me to talk about this important item.
So for people who aren't familiar with it, can you explain naloxone, or also known, I think, as Narcan?
Sure. So Narcan is the brand name, and naloxone is the medication that blocks the effect of opioids, and it reverses the overdose. It's a safe drug if you are if you're not overdosing on opioids. Even if you receive naloxone, it won't harm you. It can only help you if you are suffering an overdose.
And we're seeing this more commonly used among first responders, EMTs, some librarians are carrying it. We're seeing it in more and more places around the country, right?
Right. So when I started in the Obama administration in about 2009, this was really when we were starting to see the increase in overdose deaths. And it was very important that we address the issue, particularly at the time in rural areas. And in rural areas, the first responders often are law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time. My boss at the time was a former police chief, and he spent a lot of time speaking with his fellow former police chiefs around the country about the importance of carrying naloxone. And we also heard from law enforcement who, you know, they're members of the community, and they saw their community was suffering. And so they really wanted to do something to help. And in particular, it started in Massachusetts with this one law enforcement officer in Quincy, Mass, who said, I want to start this in my community. And he did, and it really took off from there.
That said, there's a lot of impetus to try to get police departments to have Narcan on hand, naloxone on hand, but most don't across the country. What do the numbers look like these days?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have some, it's about 2,500 law enforcement agencies around the country that currently carry. That is not I'm sure, you know, it could be higher than that, but that's kind of a self-report that we have from the best source we have, which is the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. And so some agencies really were first to start carrying, again, particularly in rural areas. In more urban areas where you had a faster emergency response, it wasn't as needed that law enforcement carried in the early stages of the epidemic. Now we are seeing more and more law enforcement agencies take it up. And also, most states have now passed laws that make it easier for, if there's a concern about liability, to protect law enforcement, as well as to expand access through harm reduction facilities and to the public, having it available through pharmacies as well. And that's something in Wisconsin, you can go to a pharmacy and receive naloxone.
Talking to Regina LaBelle from Georgetown University's Law School. She's Program Director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative. We're talking about the availability of Narcan, naloxone, for police departments to use to help stop the effects of heroin and other opioid overdoses. I understand that for police departments, Regina, in some cases, the cost of providing naloxone, at least to all of their officers, is prohibitive for some.
Yeah, so certainly, you know, local law enforcement is always stretched for budget dollars. And there are some companies are providing naloxone at a reduced cost for law enforcement. It ranges from about $12 a dose to the nasal spray and $12 a dose for some forms, and it can be about $150 for two doses. So it really depends on the type that you receive. And also, there are lots of grants that are available from the federal government through both Health and Human Services as well as the Department of Justice to help defray those costs. And given the extent of the opioid epidemic, I think that a lot of states and local governments feel that it's really necessary to bear this cost.
How much training does this require for someone, a police officer, or I guess anyone, to administer naloxone?
You know, not much. I think that, you know, for the auto injector is one of the forms that is it's the most expensive, although they do defray some of the costs. That one, you basically, it walks you through it. It walks you through the process, and it is very simple. The nasal spray it's pretty simple, too. Most of the time, law enforcement either has someone who comes to a roll call, can do the training and say, here's how you do it, can be about half an hour. It could sometimes be longer, but usually it's half an hour or even less. And there are law enforcement trainings that are available through the Bureau of Justice Assistance in the federal government, and there are others online that are available online as well. Although usually you want someone so you can, you know, have someone answer some questions you might have about opioid addiction generally. But it's a simple process to learn.
Is there resistance in any police departments around the country? And if so, why?
I have heard some concerns raised about this is not a law enforcement's duty. This is really something that that EMTs should be doing, that it's really a public health approach, not a public safety issue. There are also some concerns that are raised about basically having to administer naloxone more than once to the same person. And so those are some of the issues that we've heard raised before. But really, for the most part, law enforcement understands, again, this is a community problem, taking a community solution, and they're an important part of that solution. And they also recognize that it helps in many cases if you save a life. I'll give you an example. A D.C. police officer a couple weeks ago met him 1 week. They had just gotten naloxone. He administered it the next day. He called me the next day and said, what can I do? How can I help this young woman who I saved last night? It was a very heartwarming story, and he obviously was very touched and moved by the opportunity to save a life.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the availability of the overdose drug naloxone to police departments and elsewhere in the United States. Regina LaBelle is with us from Georgetown Law School's Addiction and Public Policy Initiative. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have people in your community started carrying naloxone or keeping it handy? If so, who has it? Police, firefighters, other first responders? Do you have it where you work if you have a publicly accessible institution of some sort? Do you have questions about what is being done around the country, the effectiveness of it? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Tina is with us in Eagle River. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Tina?
Well, I currently am a American Heart Association trainer certified, and we have adopted training in the use of naloxone, and we train at levels all the way down to the layperson at a factory. I just did it today, actually, training individuals on the use of naloxone at that level, and really haven't met a lot of resistance. Some early concerns when you first start talking about it and doing the training, and then when you assure them that, you know, of the almost no risk of administering the naloxone to somebody who has a suspected overdose, they're more than, you know, willing to learn about it. And the training does take a very short period of time. Out of the 6 hours that we trained today, really 15 minutes of it was spent on the training of naloxone use. And most of that had to do with questions and concerns regarding, you know, how easy it was to do. So I find it very refreshing that people are very interested in helping and being involved even at that level.
And Tina, can I ask, have your students, your trainees, have you heard stories back from them about actually having to use it?
No, we have not. We haven't. Most of the people that we're training wouldn't keep that in their first aid kit, so we train more to the fact that if you find somebody who has a suspected overdose and you're, you know, going through their things to find out if you could figure out what's going on and you see the naloxone, that you would then go ahead and administer it. So we haven't had anybody that currently that reported to us that, and we've been doing it for almost over 2 years now, training with naloxone.
Tina, thank you so much for sharing your experience. So better to have the training and not need it, Regina.
Yeah, it's great. And I love the fact that what Tina said, that, you know, she's with the American Heart Association and is training people on factory floors. And, you know, again, I can't stress enough how this is a community-based solution to this, you know, what appears to be such a huge problem, and it is, but it is something that each one of us can do something about.
Thanks for that call. Jenny joins us now in Wisconsin Rapids. Jenny, hi.
Hi. Yes, hi. I just wanted to share with you real briefly, I am actually a public librarian in central Wisconsin, and this past winter, our library staff plus other city employees were trained in how to administer Narcan, just in case somebody is overdosing in our library. So it's not just police officers, it's not just first responders, it is people who are working with the public every day. And, you know, oftentimes we're dealing with people who have these drug addiction issues. And recently in Wisconsin at the Sheboygan Public Library, a gentleman overdosed and died in the bathroom of their public library. So it is a serious issue. And those who are working with the public are also learning how to deal with it as well.
Jenny, thanks for sharing that story. And I know, anecdotally, Regina, a lot of librarians are contending with this issue of overdoses in their libraries and deciding whether to train their staff on naloxone use.
Right. I mean, you know, we come into contact every day with people who have substance use disorders, and people who have opioid addiction are obviously at risk for overdosing. And librarians are no different than any other, you know, public facing entity. And they're really stepping up across the country to take the issue on.
Thanks a lot for that call. Regina, obviously the ultimate solution would be to prevent addiction in the first place. Are there steps we can do to help prevent overdoses among people with opioid addictions?
Well, I mean, you know, so first of all, we know if you start at the beginning, we try to prevent substance use disorders from ever occurring. And, you know, we know that disease of addiction is a disease of early onset. So, and it usually starts with when you're, you know, a teenager. So certainly prevention is an important part of it. We also know that most people who misuse prescription opioids get them from family and friends. So disposing of prescription opioids, getting them out of your house is another important step. And then, you know, the making sure that we have we're screening people for early signs of substance use, and we're helping people who steer them to addiction treatment as they are ready to do so. And, you know, we don't have enough addiction treatment in this country. Only about 30% of people with opioid use disorders get treatment. And that number is about 10% of people with any type of substance use disorder who get treatment. So we have a long way to go in this country to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the more than 20 million people who have some form of substance use disorder. So again, it's recognizing that this is a disease, of early onset, but it can be treated, and there are many people in this country who are in recovery from a substance use disorder.
And in our last minute or so, Regina, getting back to the naloxone, if someone from a local police department out there is listening and they don't currently have naloxone available for their officers to administer, what would you tell them?
So, well, first of all, I would tell them, great, you should do it. The Bureau of Justice Assistance has some toolkits. There are lots of resources available. I know that the Wisconsin State Patrol now carries naloxone. There are lots of mentors out there who can help around the country. One of the first stops, again, is the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and they have lots of tools that can be used to teach you how to set up such a program in your police department.
We'll leave it there for now. Regina, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Regina LaBelle, Program Director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative at Georgetown University's Law School. She's with us today to talk about why the majority of police departments don't have naloxone available and what effect it has when they do. If you have stories like our callers, if you work in training people on naloxone or you are trained in it because of your job, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@wpr.org. More and more grocery shopping is happening online, and in some Wisconsin communities, that's beginning to mean online sales of beer, wine, and spirits. For WPR's ongoing series, High Tolerance, Shemaine Mills reports that it's designed to be convenient, but it's also controversial.
Grocery shopping's changing. Driving to the store no longer means having to go in the store. Instead, you can stay in your car, where items chosen online are delivered to your vehicle at a scheduled pickup time.
All right, so the click-and-go sign says, let us know you're here, text your name, or call this number.
Curbside pickup goes by various names depending on the store. Festival Foods calls it click-and-go, and I'm their first customer buying alcohol online. It's that new.
All right, I need to find my ID here because I'm assuming they'll ask for proof of age.
My ID is scanned by a grocery employee who brings out my purchase.
Yeah, like I said, the receipt's in that bag for you, and then you should be all set.
While many grocery stores sell alcohol, most of it's purchased in-store. As Rosley is strolling up and down the grocery aisles, picking out what he wants for dinner with his girlfriend. In the cart, there's some fresh fish, vegetables, and a six-pack of beer. The 24-year-old likes picking out some purchases in person, not on a computer screen.
Place your item in the bagging area.
It depends on the circumstances, but I would be open to the possibility. Currently, I would like to choose in the store.
People with kids, you know, don't want to bring their kids in and they can just pick things up.
That's former Madison Alderwoman Liddell Zellers. She voted to allow curbside pickup of alcohol at grocery stores.
And they can just pick things up, including if they do want to get some beer or wine. The other side of it is probably most people know we are a state that is known for drinking and sometimes binge drinking.
Madison City officials eventually approved curbside pickup of alcohol ordered online, but so far it's been a non-starter in Neenah, where Alderwoman Marge Bates has helped lead the charge against online alcohol. She says the Fox Valley has too much binge drinking, something that gets splashed across the national news whenever there's a story on alcohol consumption.
A couple years ago, Oshkosh and Neenah were like number two in the nation, not two in the state, two in the nation.
The battle over where and how people get booze is being debated across Wisconsin because curbside pickup of alcohol ordered online is relatively new, and it's local officials like Bates who will decide whether a retailer can amend their liquor license to allow it.
Well, I understand people needing to get their groceries out in their car. When I had little kids, I would have loved to be able to do that, but it's one more step to say, I can't get out of my car to get alcohol. It's not like the same thing as I need diapers. I need milk.
For over a year, in nearby Appleton, a Pick and Save grocery has offered curbside pickup of alcohol. Officer Megan Cash says so far they haven't had any problems with minors trying to buy alcohol or intoxicated drivers.
There's always concern when anything changes, but it appears that we have a pretty good plan in place to safeguard any issues that would come up.
Brandon Scholes from the Wisconsin Grocers Association predicts online shopping will be the norm someday.
This business will double in the next year or two, and double and double and double. It will grow significantly.
He's talking about online food sales, but with grocery stores selling a significant amount of alcohol purchased in the state, that will also mean beer, wine, and spirits in communities that decide to allow it. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our ongoing series, High Tolerance, looking at drinking in Wisconsin. Find that at WPR.org/alcohol.